Now we're holding on Kuf Zayin Amud Beis by the Mishnah. So we've been learning in the parakol various dinim of when a person sells land to somebody else, and how much of a leeway, how much of a margin of error can there be, et cetera, et cetera. So now the Mishnah says, Ha'omel chaver chatsi sodani mocholach. Somebody says to somebody else, I'm selling you half my field, but he doesn't specify which half, and do we mean the half in area, do we mean the half in value? So mishamnin b'nehin, what we do is we mishamnin between them. The word mishamnin comes from the word shuman. So it means, in other words, the field is going to have, generally, a field is going to have better parts, fatter parts, so to speak, and less good parts. So mishamnin b'nehin would basically, on the surface, would mean that they divide between them the fat and the not so fat. The fat and the not so fat parts of the land. So in other words, on the face of it, it means that he's going to give him half, he's going to have to make sure that he gives him a half that includes some of the good land and some of the not so good. We're going to see in the Gemara, it doesn't necessarily mean that. Anyway, v'noto chatzis sadehu, and therefore, so he gets half the field. What about if he tells him, chetzia b'dorim ani moichaloch, if he tells him, I'm selling you half the field that's in the south. So now, in other words, unlike in the previous case where you could argue he might just as well get in any part of the field, here he specified a side of the field. Same thing, Meshamnin Benehem. We have to be Meshamnin between the two of them. We have to figure out the Shuman of the land, the Notochetzia Badarim, and he ends up getting half of the land in the south of in the south end of the field. The womb of Kabul Olav, now he has to accept on him, and we'll talk about in a second, who's the he? Mokama Geder, the space that's going to be needed to build the fence around the property, because as it talks about at the beginning of the Masechta, when you have in the case of a chotzer, for example, if people are dividing a chotzer, then you build a wall, so there's no hezek re'iyah. In the case of fields, the Gemara mentions over there, the Mishnah mentions over there, and the Gemara expands on it, you don't necessarily need because people aren't in fields as often. Nevertheless, there are places where they have the minhag to build a fence. So there has to be a space for that fence. So there's going to have to be. So the Rashban learns that the Mahuma Kabul Olav means the seller. Besides that, he's going to have to. So here, for he said, I'm selling you half my field. That means now we need a fence between the half that you're buying and the half that I'm keeping. So therefore, the seller is going to have to give from his own land the space that's going to be needed to build that fence. And also he's going to need to provide space for the ditch around the field and for the minor ditch. Choritz is a big ditch, and Ben Choritz is a smaller one. As we're going to see in the Gemara, the purpose of them is to keep certain wild animals out of the field. So all of that, so the Rashbam learns that all of those has to, the space for those has to be provided by the seller. So on the other hand, the Rambam learns that, in other words, basically, because the Rashbam says, when you're selling a person a half a field, means you're selling him everything that's going to be needed for that field to work. So if he sells him a whole field, of course, he sells him the whole thing with everything that goes with it. There's already a choritz and ben choritz. Of course, those are included. The chiddush is over here where he's selling him a half a field, and now a new fence and now a new choritz and ben choritz are going to need to be put up. So the Rashbam learns that it means that the seller is going to have to provide the space for all of those. The Rambam learns rather that it means that the half that he gets is going to also have to include the space. He's going to have to realize that some of that half is going to go towards these things if he wants his field to be safe from animals and robbers and whatnot.
It just makes it like a fence.
The choritz is a ditch that keeps animals out of the field, and we're going to see in the Gemara why you need two of them. You need a bigger ditch and a smaller ditch for reasons that we're going to learn in the Gemara.
Did we learn in the first mission already that Tashutfim have to give half and half?
So again, that was when it comes to a Shachotzer, where there each one has to give half, but here we're talking about a field where in general you don't usually need a fence between fields necessarily, but you do need a Choritz and Ben Choritz. Somebody has to provide the space for that. So again, according to the Rashbam, it's the seller, and according to the Rambam, it's the buyer. The kamahu choritz, how wide would the ditch be? Shishatvachim, or ben choritz, and the smaller ditch, shlosha, would be three tvachim, and there's a space between them, as we're going to learn in the Gemara. There is the Yad Ramah brings a Girsa rather that the Choretz would be 9 Tfachim and the Ben Choretz would be 3. So 6 or 9 according to the different Girsas. So the Gemara says, Amar Pachia Ba'aba Amar Yechanan, Lekeach Noto Kocho Shabai. Now when we're saying, now we have to consider that you have the concept Yad Lekeach Halatachtoina, the one who's buying has the lower hand, because the one who's selling the field is the one who's Mochsek, he's the one who's Mochsek, and I'm Motzim Chavela Radayim. So if the buyer wants to be able to claim that he's entitled to a certain part of the field, then he's going to have to bring a proof. And you can't, because you just said in general, that you just said generically, I'm selling you half a field. So therefore, the lekeach is going to end up getting the lesser part, but it's going to be. In other words, when we say chatzi asadeh, again, it can mean half of the area or it can mean half the value. So we can say he might have meant half the value of the field. So what you do is, in other words, we say that. Now there is the advantage. There is the advantage. After all, a person would, you know, you could argue. So what? It's 50 zuz is 50 zuz. What's the difference of the quality of the land? But the fact is, a person would much rather have a smaller amount of land idis rather than a larger amount of land ziburis. So the moichel gains by that, by being able to give him 50. Let's say the field is worth 100 zuz, he can give him 50 zuz out of the lesser parts of the field. So in that case, the meshamnin b'nehen, the Rashbam explains, would just mean, in other words, that the lekeach is in other words, if the result of that is that he's going to have to give him more than half the acreage of the field in order to make up that half of value, that he has to do. That's the meshamnin b'nehem. In that sense, the lekeach does gain something. The lekeach does gain something. He's getting 50 zuz worth of the field, that may end up being more than half the area of the field. It may end up being more than half the area of the field. So in that sense, he's not completely losing out.
He's going to get more than half because it's worth more.
So to give the example, let's say, for example, so you have a field which is worth 100. You have a field which is worth 100 zuz. You have, say, for example, 30. You have, for example, 30 square amas or whatever it is in it are worth 50, and the other 70 are also worth 50. So he would give him the 70. It's more than half the area of the field, but it's worth half the value of the field. So in that sense, that way, the meshamnin b'nehen, each one of them is getting a certain shumen. So we don't mean, as we thought in the Mishnah, that it means that each of them is going to be entitled to half the shumen, half the fat land in the field. No, he could give him all ziburis, but he has to give him enough that it'll be worth half the value of the field. The Rashbam points out that there's a Gemara in Bechoros that also brings this and also uses the expression Meshamnin Benehem. You have a similar discussion over there as far as a case of a Suffolk Bechor. So the Rashbam compares and contrasts that actually over there, the Lekeach loses out, more. Even though it uses the expression Meshamnin also, but here the Lekeach is not losing out quite so much. He does get the Ziburis, but at least he gets a larger area of it. So Amalei Rav Chiya Ba'aba L'Rav Yechanan. So now Rav Chiya Ba'aba said that in the name of Rav Yechanan, but now he asks Rav Yechanan, how could we say that? V'hanan Meshamnin B'nehem Tznan. Didn't we learn in the Mishnah Meshamnin B'nehem, and on the face of it, that means that each of them has to get some kind of the Shuman. Or another way we could understand the word meshamnin might be related to the word shuma, as in an evaluation. We have to evaluate the respective parts of the field and see.
Well, you already answered that before.
So fine, we could answer that, right? But Rav Chiya Ba'aba is bothered by it. I know I'm saying in your name, Rabbi Yochanan, that this is how it is, but I'm asking, why should it be? Doesn't the simple meaning of meshamnin mean that we should have to divide the shuman between them? Omalei, so Rabbi Yochanan answers him, Ad achalta kathniyosa b'bavel, while you were busy eating dates in Bavel. Rabbi Yochanan was originally from Bavel and moved to Eretz Yisrael. So while you were busy enjoying yourself in Bavel, he's like, Rashbam says he's kind of a canter, and he's kind of like teasing him, like you were too busy with your gashmiistic pleasures in Bavel, eating dates, and you didn't spend enough time learning Torah. Meanwhile, Tagdimna Misefa, meanwhile we in Eretz Yisrael were looking at the Sefa of the Mishnah and understanding from it what the word Meshamnin in our Mishnah means.
So the Gemara mentions in a couple of places that dates grew plentifully in Babel. There's even places where the Gemara mentions that that's Dafka. Why did the Eibishter arrange that the original Golos, acted by the Churban Bayis Rishon, was to Babel out of all the countries in the world? Because dates grow plentifully over there, and they're cheap and very nourishing. The Gemara in Ksubas mentions a number of good qualities of dates, and that way Jews could spend less time having to work for a living and more time able to learn Torah. So nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan is telling him that the fact is you put a little too much effort into Gashmius over there. That's how the Rashbam learns. In the Gemara in Bechoris, where you also have this discussion over there, Tosfos points out that actually the word Kachniyosa doesn't mean actually date. It doesn't mean regular full ripe date. It actually means a type of date blossoms that are never going to develop into full dates. So it means, in other words, that he's saying that. Like you were muching zichin bava, like all you had, as if like all you had was the unripe dates to eat. Meanwhile, in Eretz Yisrael, we were doing the good job of learning the Mishnah thoroughly and understanding it properly. So Targumim is safer. We understood it based on the safer. The Katani safer. Chetzia b'donim ani yomaychalach. Because our Mishnah continues that if he said I'm selling you half that's in the south, meshamnin b'neihem, then we also meshamnin between them. V'noto chetzia b'donim, and then he gets half of the land that's in the south. Now v'amai meshamnin b'neihem. Now you would have to ask if you're going to think that it means that when he says chatzi soda ani moichaloch, means he actually has to give him a half of the field, a half of the area, and meaning, in other words, in order to make it fair, he's going to have to make sure that half is going to include some of the idiots as well. If that were the case, then in the sefer of the Mishnah, why would he get chetzi b'dorim? V'amai m'shamnin v'neim, v'al chetzi b'dorim, k'omolei. He says half in the south, so then on the face of it, that would mean, in other words, I'm selling you the southern half of the field. So that would be that. So what do you mean? So what do you mean, Meshamnin Benehen?
Is Darim the idiots in general?
No, the point is, in other words, in the ratio of the Mishnah, he's saying generically, I'm selling you half the field. Right. So we could discuss whether it means half of the area or half the value or whatever. But in the Sefer, when he says I'm selling you the southern half of the field, wouldn't that most obviously mean the southern half, as in we measure the length of the field, and we take the half we measure the length of the field, we find it's 100 amos long, and then we say there's a from north to south, so then we say, fine, the southern 50 amos has been sold, and yet the Mishnah is saying, Meshamnin b'neihem. So it means, in other words, that it's not that, so even in the case of the Sefer, it doesn't mean that he's going to be getting the half the area, in other words, like we just said, that we're going to measure, find it 100 feet long and give him 50 amos, but rather, Eloladomi, we're going to figure out as far as the value. We're going to say, in other words, how much of the southern end of this field is worth half the value of the entire field. So it might be, depending on the circumstances, it might be more or less than, half of the area. So therefore, Hachinav Gadami, the same way, says Rabbi Yochanan, and the ratio also, we have to understand that it means in terms of money rather than in terms of area. So that's how it is. Where either way, in other words, the moicher has his choice of what he's going to give. So you do have there is the Meshamnin Benehan. Both of them have a hana. The moicher gains that he may get to keep the land that's intrinsically more that's better quality. But on the other hand, the lekeach is gaining in that he's getting a larger area, if the moicher so chooses. So Rabbi Yochanan says that's what the Mishnah means. So don't wonder what it means Meshamnin Benehem, and on the face of it, it means you have to give him always half and make sure that it's half as far as area and as far as money. No, both parts of the Mishnah are talking strictly the domain as far as the value.
So why is he using Meshamnin?
That's the thing. So we're saying the word Meshamnin because each of them is gaining something. The Moicher is gaining that he gets to keep the better quality land, but the Lekeach is gaining that he gets a larger area of land.
Lekeach was richer than Mishnah. I mean,
in the Reisha we're saying he didn't specify what side he's selling. So what we do is, so the Moicher has his choice. He can say, I'm gonna survey all the ziburis of the land until I reach 50 zuz worth, and that's what I'm gonna give him, let's say. And that's valid because he didn't specify otherwise.
In the Sefer, he
specified the southern end. So all it means is it has to be start from the southern end and work our way north. But how far north we're gonna be working is gonna depend on until we reach a value of 50 zuz.
No, so he's going to get the same thing.
So he's going to get, so either way, he's getting 50 zuz worth of land, but in both cases, each of them has what to gain, which is why we use the word Meshamnin, yeah.
One second.
Yeah.
The Mishnah doesn't say anywhere that the purchase of the land is for agricultural purposes, does it?
No, but I mean, generally when people are buying land, it is. So it's true, right. I mean, it's a fair point. I mean, obviously, once he has the land, he could decide that he doesn't want to use it for agricultural purposes. He wants to use it to build a house, for example. It doesn't really matter whether it's Idis or Zubotis or whatever. Obviously, we go according to the current value of it. I mean,
The value is all dependent on what the function is going to be, how it's going to be used. And nobody says in the Mishnah that it's for agricultural purposes. So
but in general, first of all, when they sold land in those days, generally the default assumption was that it was for agricultural purposes. And also, yeah, I mean, listen, nowadays also you could have you buy a piece of land and then it gets rezoned and all of a sudden it's worth a lot more or a lot less or whatever, how things are going to happen afterwards. You can't predict. Put it this way, all of it, when we talk about this land is worth X amount, we're not talking about that the seller or the buyer themselves are just going to decide it on their own. They're going to call in a panel of experts, like we learned yesterday in the Gemara, and they're going to go and they're going to consider all these possibilities, what the land conceivably might be used for and so forth. Keep in mind, I mean, if this is land out in the middle of a place of fields, for example, you're probably not going to have if the guy's going to build a house there in the middle of nowhere. Houses are usually built in towns. So, if there is the possibility that the land could be repurposed for another purpose, then, yeah, obviously the surveyors and the assessors are going to take that into account.
Okay. No, well, we know that. But,
yeah,
but
well,
when
that's
you
the
say
point
that you're saying that both have to gain, not necessarily. I mean, if the buyer wants to build instead of a
where we're going to go in. When we talk about that this particular plot of land is worth 50 zuz, that's going to be based on an assessment made by experts, and the experts are going to take such things into consideration. If afterwards...
Even if it's not by the experts?
No, if afterwards the buyer unexpectedly decides to take and do something else with the property, I mean, you can say the same thing. What if after the sale is done, the Lekeach is digging over there and finds a buried treasure? You know, I mean, you could have all kinds of scenarios, but we have to go according to the facts that we have in hand.
Right.
Okay. Onward. The Mishnah said Makabal of Mokum Gedder. V'chola, we said that there has to be a fence over there, that the land for it has to be supplied by one of them, whichever one between the argument between the Rashbam and the Rambam. And we said you have a choritz and a ben choritz. So what is the first of all, how are those ditches located? Choritz mibachutz or ben choritz mibifnim. The choritz, the bigger ditch, is located outside the fence. Both of them are located outside the fence, but Choritz and Bachutz is further out away from the fence. Or Ben Choritz Mibifnim, no, because he's going to go on. Ben Choritz Mibifnim means closer to the inside, but still not on the actual inside of the field. But rather, the Zevezeh Achorida Geder, both of them on the other side of the fence, outside of the field. And the point of them is, Kadesh Leite Chaya Kefetzis. The purpose is that wild animals can't jump. If you just had a fence over there, for example, then certain kinds of wild animals can jump onto the fence and then get from there into the field and go and start destroying it.
Yes.
So therefore, you have ditches over there that prevent an animal from being able to jump onto the fence in the first place. So the Gemara asks, "V'leved choritz, v'leved ben choritz." So why don't you just make the ditch? Why do you need the second ditch as well? And the answer is, "I did a rovach because there's space because the ditch itself is wide." When we said in the Mishnah that the ditch is six tefachim wide. There's also Meforshim explained that it would be six tefachim deep as well. Six tefachim wide is enough of an area that an animal can get a foothold over there. So therefore, so kaim v'gabe, so it's going to stand, the animal will stand inside the ditch. V'kofza, and then it'll jump from there, and it'll brace itself from there and jump onto the fence. So we're not talking about large animals. We're talking about like smaller animals. The Rambam, when he brings this halacha, for example, mentions, for example, a nemiya, which is a small creature like a weasel or a ferret or something like that. So nowadays, for example, a squirrel or a raccoon or something, for example.
Do they damage fields?
Or? Yeah, they'll eat. The deer
can jump over. Deer eats vegetables.
Deer, there's not much you can do unless you're going to make a really tall fence. So, you know, deer you're going to have to take your chances with. But as far as the smaller animals, at least, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of them are omnivores. They'll eat anything, yeah.
So you're saying that you make, you have the charitz?
So wait. So the question is, so why don't you have then just this small ditch, which is too small then for the animal to be able to get a solid foothold in there, and then you don't need the large ditch? And the answer is, I did a cotton. Yeah, but because the small ditch is very narrow, therefore an animal like a weasel or whatever would be able to stand on the edge of it, the cuffs, and be able to jump from the fence onto it. So you need both ditches. In other words, that way it tries to jump from one ditch to the other. The big ditch is too far away from the fence to be able to reach, and there's not enough of a foothold between one ditch and the other for it to be able. The kama ben choritz ben choritz tefach. The space between the two ditches should be a tefach, and that way that covers all our bases. And now, if an animal tries to jump from one to the other, then it's not going to be able to.
Which ditch comes first? The bigger?
So the bigger ditch is further towards the outside, and the bigger ditch is further towards the outside. Then you have the smaller ditch closer to the fence. And then so it's arranged in such a way now that an animal like a weasel or whatever is not easily going to be able to jump across and to scale the fence because you have that whole arrangement of ditches, and therefore the animal instinctively feels that it can't get a foothold. And the Rambam, when he phrases the halacha, says kedishle tikvitz and nemiyah, so that way a nemiyah, like a weasel or whatever, won't be able to jump.
The original owner did not have all the fences and all these.
So the original owner, remember, it was one big field. He had a fence and ditches and whatever around the entire field.
Right.
But now we have a new place in the middle where now we have the border between one field and the next. Within one property and the next. So now we need a new fence there. We need a new choritz and ben choritz over there.
And if the whole thing is fenced in anyway, so it's...
Maybe, but not necessarily. I mean, what happens if, after all, if animals do get into your field, then I still want to keep them out of mine. And you know what the fact is? I mean, it depends. Obviously, they might decide mutually between them that we don't need it. But for example, you have at the beginning of the Masechta, in the first parak, there was a case over there where you have one person whose fields completely surround somebody else's, and the outer one starts building a fence. Unless we know that the inner one is gaining from that fence, for example, that he helped helped with construction or whatever, then we can't. So we say, yeah, the Mishnah describes over there how if it's completely fenced in, Megalgal and all of us are called, then you require him to pay his share of the entire fence because then he's gaining from it, because then even the outer one has his fence around his field, but it's also useful to have a fence around your field. So like this, the inner one could say, as long as it's only one, two, three sides fenced in, fine, I'm not gaining from it. My field is still directly open to yours, but once it's closed in, then yes. So the same way over here. In other words, hypothetically, if the original owner has a fence and a ditch around the whole thing, then yeah, you're right. Hypothetically, we don't need one between the two fields, but we might. He might say, nevertheless, I still want that extra security.
Now, when he built the fence, according to Mishnah, he's saying you have to build it outside his parameter. It looks like he's getting a little more than...
So that's the thing. According to the Rambam, yes, the Moicher has to give up an extra piece of land for that purpose. According to the Rambam, it would be that the buyer is the one who's going to be doing that. Okay. Hadron Aloch Beis Kor. So now we have a change in that we're going to have in our Masechta. Until now, seven Prokim we've been going through, and very little of the dinim that we've been learning come from Psukim. You have in the first parak when it talks about dividing property and different dinim related, building fences and things like that. The second parak about hilchos shchenim, about keeping my hezek from far away from your property, my potential hezek away from your property, etc. The third parak about chazaka, the fourth, fifth, and sixth and seventh parak about the various dinim of buying and selling. Basically, all of that has been based on the chachamim's evaluation of how people do things. And on Minig HaMokim and things like that. Now we're going to be talking about the Dinim of Yerusha, which is more directly based on Psukim. So our Perek and the next one are going to talk about the Dinim of Yerusha, we're going to focus on the actual order of Yerusha, who Yarshins from whom. And then we also have in the Dinim of Yerusha in the Torah. You have in Parshas Pinchas, you have the basic Seder Nachlos, which we're going to go through. And then you have in Parshas Kiseitse, the concept that a Bechor gets a double portion. So all of those are going to be dealt with in our Perek, which means much more than elsewhere in the Masechta. We're going to be dealing with psukim and with drushes then.
There's a bracha a little helps them. Well, yeah. It's a bracha also, like this parsha.
Yeah.
Speaking a little about the
Patron. There's a bracha talks about, I mean, it mentions that the Jewish people are going to inherit
Eretz Yisrael. No, the different shvatim with their gods.
Oh, well, yeah, okay, that's true. That's true, actually. Our perek is going to deal in detail with how the Eretz Yisrael was divided among the shvatim. So, yeah, that's true. Okay. So the Mishnah starts off, yesh noichelin umanchilin. There are some kinds of relatives who inherit from their relatives, and they can in turn cause the same kind of relative to inherit. So meaning, in other words, let's say, for example, a father and son. The father passes away, the son inherits. If the son passes away before the father, and he doesn't have any children of his own, then the father will inherit, as we're going to work out the details. So you have some bilateral relationships like that. The yesh noichlin, and the Rashbam points out, the Loshin could have just been yesh noichlin zeh zeh, but the Mishnah wants to point out the contrasts between, there are noichlin manchilin, there are noichlin and not manchilin, and so forth, and therefore the Mishnah phrased it like that. Yesh noichlin v'le manchilin, then there are ones who inherit from relatives, but though they don't in turn cause those relatives to inherit, as the Mishnah is going to go and give us examples. You have the other way around, where a particular person dies and a certain relative inherits from him, but he would not inherit from that relative if it had been the other way around, if that relative had died. We're going to see examples of all of them in the Mishnah. And then you have relatives who don't yarshin from each other at all, from either one at all. So what do we mean? So let's start with the first group. A father will inherit his children, and his children, or the father, if he passes away, his children will inherit. And the children will cause the father to inherit if they die. So those are examples of noichlin manchilin. Va'achin min ha'av, and another example is paternal brothers who share the same father. So even if they have different mothers, the Yerusha goes through the father, so all of them are going to inherit from one another. So all of those, noichlin manchilin, each of those, if either member of the pair dies, then the other one is going to yashin from him. Tosfos points out, by the way, that now you have, when the Mishnah gives us a thing like this, a general thing like this and yesh that, sometimes the Mishnah will begin then by analyzing the first one in the list. Sometimes instead it will start by analyzing the last one in the list. For example, you have it in Masechta Shabbos, for example, you have Bame Madlikin or Bame Ein Madlikin, and the Mishnah starts off Ein Madlikin, not with this and not with that and so forth. So there you have it. They call it a chiastic structure, which means basically like a letter X. Like you start with A, then you mention A, then B, then you start analyzing B, and eventually you go back to A. So it's like an X. On the other hand, sometimes you have, where the Mishnah will do it, it gives the ones in the straight order, and it starts discussing them in the same order as it listed them originally. So Tosfos points out the Gemara in Nedarim explains why that is, why are some Mishnayos arranged one way and some the other. So, one thing is over here, you have four different categories, so if you started listing them out of order, it would get very confusing, so it's much more straightforward having listed the four categories to also explain them in order. Anyway, so again, so the first category is ones where it's bilateral, either one of them passes away, the other one inherits. The next group, ha'ishes imoy va'ishes ishtoy, a man with his mother and a man with his wife, uvnei achoyos, or children of sisters, which we'll talk about in a second, what sisters we're talking about. Noichlin v'le manchilin. So in each case, there will be Yerusha in one direction, but not in the other. Namely, in other words, a man yashins from his mother, but the reverse is not true. If he passes away, his mother doesn't yashin him. The same way, a man yashins from his wife, as the Gemara is going to work out in detail in our parak, what the source for that is, but the reverse is not true. She doesn't yashin from him. By the way, you'll notice already, you know, that a lot of the dinim that we're going to have in our perek are obviously a lot different, lahavdil, than American law, for example. There's an organization called the Business Halacha Institute. In American law, for example, a man's wife yashins him, no problem. And in fact, I think he sometimes, even if not otherwise specified, that if a person dies without a will, then she'll yashin him. So there's actually an organization called the Business Halacha Institute where they deal with various matters of halacha in business that people may not be aware of, and one of their initiatives is for people to write a will that will be valid according to halacha and lahavdil, according to secular law as well. Anyway, So it doesn't mean, by the way, of course, you know, we learned back in Ksubas, the widow doesn't remain completely high and dry. First of all, she has a Ksuba to collect, and until then, she's entitled to Mizoynus, to live in the same house that he lived in, and so on and so forth. So, yeah. But as far as actual Yerusha, that now. Anyway, as far as the Bnei Achoyis, Rashbam discusses over here two possibilities. It can mean where there are two sisters who share the same father. So now, if one of the sisters dies, then her son inherits her, and if she doesn't have any children, then her nephew. Remember that girls don't yarshin when there are boys. But if you have like nice slufchot, for example, where there's no boys, then the girls yarshin. So now, for example, if both of the women had sons, and then one of them, she and her son die, then her nephew is going to yarshin everything. So he's going to yarshin her. It's going to go down to him. It's going to work out. So that's one meaning of Bnei Achoyis. And the other possibility that Ashbam mentions is that Bnei Achoyis would mean actually that it means his nephews. So for example, let's say Reuven and Dina are brother and sister. Ashbam gives an example. So now if Reuven passes away without any children, and he has no other brothers, then Dina is going to yarshin him. And in turn, if Dina passes away, then Dina's son is going to yarshin him. So that's another meaning of Bnei Achoyis. Okay. Continues the Mishnah. Her ishas baneha or ishas baila. Now a woman to her children and a woman to her husband. Va'acheha em and brothers from the mother's side. Manchilin v'lenoichilin. All of those can cause the other one to inherit, but not inherit from them. So again, a wife doesn't inherit from her husband. A mother doesn't inherit from her son. And brothers from the mother's side. And then brothers from the mother's side, one of them will inherit from the other, but not the other way. Acheya aim means brothers of the mother. So a man's mother passed away, and she doesn't have so he yarshins from her. But now if he passes away, then that's going to go to his uncle.
Brothers.
It's going to go to his own, to his uncle, to her brother, but not the other way around. Then we have maternal brothers, like for example, Yaakov's children are paternal brothers. Maternal brothers who share the same mother but different fathers, loy neuchlin, v'loy manchilin. There's no inheritance between one and the other at all. They're not considered mishpacha, as the Gemara is going to work out how we know that.
So Rachel
and Leah is the other way around. Their children are, they all share the same father, Yaakov, but they have different mothers.
Right.
Let's say a woman is married and her husband passes away or divorces her and she remarries somebody else. So she has two different sets of children from two different fathers. So they have the same mother but different fathers. They're not going to yarshin from each other. Okay. So the Gemara starts off. Maishna de Katani ha'avas abonim bereisha. Why does the Mishnah first start by saying that when the father passes away, his children inherit him? Why didn't the Mishnah begin by saying first that if the children pass away, then their father inherits them? So the answer is, first of all, number one, we don't want to begin with something of poor honors.
Wow.
That a father passes away and his children outlive him is a perfectly normal kind of thing. But that it should be the other way around as a matter of poor honors. And we don't want to begin, the Mishnah didn't want to begin, the Tana didn't want to be, especially the son himself is childless, because that's the whole point. If the son himself has children, then the Yerusha is going to go to his children. It reverts to his father only if he has no surviving children. So therefore, it would be a real poronos that a man died childless and yet during his father's lifetime. So therefore, the Mishnah didn't want to mention that. To have that a father should pass away and his son outlives him, that Ashbam points out. Listen, not only it's a normal thing, but you find even, for example, Yaakov Avinu is given the good news by the Eibishter, Yosef Yoshis Yodei Alenecha, that Yosef will be the one to bury you. So that's not a poronos, that's the normal way of things. So that's first of all. V'oid, another reason why the Mishnah didn't want to begin that way, k'dichtiv, because after all, the pasuk begins, ishti yomos uvenein loy. That when a person dies and he doesn't have children, then the pasuk starts listing what happens. First, if he doesn't have sons and his daughters yarshin him, and if he doesn't have sons or daughters, then his relatives from his father's side yarshin him, etc. So the point is, the implication is, why do we have to go through that whole rigmarole? Because he had no children. But if he had children, then they would yarshin him. So therefore, so in effect, in other words, this parasha of Nachlis in parashas Pinchas is beginning implicitly with the case where a person dies and has children and then leaves behind children. So therefore, so the Mishnah started with that in a similar vein. So that would be a reason why to start that way. So the Gemara points out the Tana, and furthermore, I did ask you the Midrasha Chavivale, because now on the other hand, the Tana did want to mention, he did mention Ha'avas Abonim as well, because so that he starts out with Ha'avas Abonim, because also the fact that a father can yarshin from his children, it doesn't explicitly say in the pasuk, it comes from a Midrasha Chavivale, so therefore it's more precious to him. So therefore he wants to mention that point first. Actually, the Rashbam explains. Sorry, I said it wrong. What we said, Aschulei Bepurinisa, and all of that is all part of the question that Rashbam explains. Maskana Dekushu. So the question is, when it said Ha'avas Abonim, which should have said Ha'avas Abonim as Abereisha, and the reason why we would say that, so we'd say the other way around. It should have started Abonim as Ab, the children inherit from the father, and the reason would be because first of all, we don't want to begin with Puranis. And second of all, because the pasuk begins ishtiyamos, so all of that is a question. Why did the Mishnah start with that? Why did the Mishnah start when it lists out the details with ha'avas abanim, meaning that a father yarshins from his children, rather than the other way around, which a father yarshining from his children is a matter of puranos and is not the way it says it in the pasuk? So that's all the question. And the answer is that the Tana had a different reason that overrides that. The Tana, because the fact that a father yarshins from his children comes from a drosha, it doesn't explicitly say in the pasuk, and therefore it was more choviv to him, and he wanted to mention it first. Aye, it's Mepuranusa, and aye, it's this, but nevertheless, something that comes from a drosha is more important many times to begin with. I'll derech like you have, though, the Medrash has the expression, the Ebishtei himself says, Chavivin divrei, Chavim alai, divrei sofrim, yosim divrei Torah. What the Chachamim derive in laws of Torah is more precious to me than what it says clearly in the Torah. So there's a sicha someplace, I haven't been able to find it, but I remember once coming across a sicha where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea of why indeed the pasuk doesn't mention that when a person passes away, that is, I mean, he's childless, that his father would inherit him, where the pasuk mentions that if he has no children, then his father's brothers inherit him. And the idea is because ishti yomos also represents a person is dead, beruchnius, and needs to be revived. And the problem is that the problem is precisely that he doesn't have a relationship with the Eibishter, so he can't say that he has a father and therefore that the father should yarshin for him, because the whole point is we need to revive his relationship with his father, with the Eibishter, before we can talk any further. So my drasha. So what is the drasha that where do we see where is the drasha that tells us that a father yarshins his children? So the Tanya. Now the pasuk says after it lists the whole group of yoshim ishti yomos uvenein loy, etc. And eventually it says that if he has none of these relatives, then you give the yerusha l'she'eroi. She'eroi means his relative. Well, the Gemara is later on in the Perek, the Gemara is going to darshan that She'eroi sometimes means his wife, and that's one of the sources that says that he darshans his wife. We're going to work out, because it sounds like you give it to his wife, but we said in the Mishnah it's the other way around, the wife doesn't inherit from the husband. So we'll work that out later in the Perek. But anyway, Right now, we're understanding She'erei, his relative, Zeha'av, that refers to the father, because that's the only close blood relative, which is not mentioned in the Psukim. And the fact is that Ashbam points out, you have, for example, you have the expression, the Gemara is going to point out later on, you have the expression She'erei Vichahi, talking about relatives of your father that are Arayas, which here we're going to be reading about Yom Kippur afternoon, and it has the expression She'erei Vichahi, so we see that She'er is a term that has to do with the father. So she'eres ha'av melamed she'av kodem la'achin. That means that the father comes ahead of the brothers. Meaning, in other words, if Reuven, or the Rashbam types it out, if Reuven dies childless, it's not going to be Shimon and Levi and so forth who inherit him. If Yaakov is still alive, Yaakov is going to be the one yashin him. Right. Only if Yaakov has already passed away, only then does it go to Reuven, to Shimon and Levi and so forth.
So that's the yakar.
That's the chaviv alei, the fact that we learn that from the pasuk. Now the Braisa continues. Yochol yehi kodem laben. Now you would think maybe that would be. Now the Gemara is going to ask later on that if we're learning it from She'erei. She'erei is all the way at the end of the list. So how are we putting him ahead even of the brothers? The Gemara is going to work that out. The Gemara is going to work that out later on. A lot of this actually, what I'm saying, the Gemara is going to work this out a lot later on. A lot of it is on Daf Kuftes, which is tomorrow's daf. Anyway. So the question is, if we're already putting the father ahead, if we're already putting Yaakov in our scenario ahead of Shimon and Levi, how do we know maybe they go ahead of Reuven's children as well? Maybe even if Reuven left children, Chanoch and Palu and so forth, then Yaakov would go ahead of them. So Talmud Lomar Hakorev. No, therefore the Pasuk says that you have to, the Pasuk says the She'erei Hakorev Elov. Meaning the word HaKorev, who's near, Korev, Koidim, the nearer relative goes first. So that means that the children go ahead of the father. So Tosfos brings what the Gemara was asking was that you would think that maybe all it means is the father goes ahead of the children, maybe not necessarily would he go ahead of the brothers. And Tosfos discusses that, no, that maybe it would be that he goes ahead of all of them. Tosfos also wonders, though, in that case, how would the children ever inherit if you're always going to have that the father comes first? Then what's going to happen if the father's alive? He's yarshining, and if not, then it goes to all his children. So in that case, how hypothetically would the children if we were to say hypothetically that the father goes ahead of all the yoshin, even the children, then how would the children ever inherit? So Tosfos says, okay, fine, you could talk about, let's say, for example, you have a ger as children, so he doesn't have a father in halacha, he only has children, so then you would say that would be the case where children yashin. Or Tosfos goes on and discusses various other possibilities. So we're saying, korev, the nearer the relative, the higher he is in the list of Yerusha. Well, then the question becomes, Amara Isa L'Rabbis L'Ben or L'Hoisiyat Ach. In that case, then what makes us say that the children go ahead of the father of the mess, but the brothers do not? In other words, we're saying the order is like this. The mess's children go first. Sons, if there are, daughters, if there aren't any sons, as we're going to talk about in the parent. Now we're saying the next one is the father. And after the father come the brothers. So in our example over here, Reuven's inheritance first would go ideally to Chanoch and Palu and the other children of his mentioned in Chumash. Then if he doesn't have any children or descendants from those children, then it goes to Yaakov. And if Yaakov is... If Reuven has no sons, then it goes to daughters. If there's no daughters or sons, then it goes to Yaakov. And if Yaakov's no longer living, then it goes to Shimon and Levi, etc. Right. So we're saying, though, because we're saying HaKorev, Korev, Koidim. So what makes us say that the children are considered more Korev than the brothers? That we're saying, in other words, that the children go first, then the father, and then the brothers. Maybe we should say the other way around. Maybe the brothers are considered to be the closer relatives, and then the order would be brothers, and then father, and then children, or brothers and children, or father, or something like that. The answer is Marbanias Aben Shekin Kom Tachas Aviv L'Yada. The reason why to say that the son is considered a closer relative, Chanoich, in our example, is because he stands in place of his father as far as the din of Yiud. We learned in Masechta Kiddushin all about the dinim of Omer Hivriya, and the Torah tells us that ideally the Omer Hivriya, after she's sold by her father to work for 6 years or until she becomes a begeris, until she becomes a naira, whichever comes first. Anyway, the ideal would be that the master or his son does yield, that essentially the money that was paid for her service is that for her to work is going to become the Kesef Kiddushin, and he's going to marry her and make her a full-fledged member of the household. And the din is, the pasuk says, that the one who does the yield could be the father or it could be the son, the imlivno yodena. The same concept that can apply to the father also applies to the son. So therefore we see the son stands in place of his father. That's a very strong reason to say that he should be considered a closer relative in our case as well. Meaning, in other words, Rashbam teaches out. Now, obviously, you can be Makadosh or to whoever you want. But in other words, the point is, if it was anybody else other than the Odin or his son, then you would need new Kiddushin. And because she's a Ktana, you would need her father to be receiving the Kiddushin money on her behalf. But when it's the Odin himself or his son, nothing further is needed. The Kesef Mikneh, the money that was paid for her originally, automatically becomes the Kesef Kiddushin, and nothing further is needed. So therefore, so you see that the son stands in place of his father as far as that, and also the Sedei Achuzah. And also as far as the din of a Sedei Achuzah, where if you have a person donates a field that he inherited from his ancestors in Eretz Yisrael, he donates it to Hekdesh, then he has the ability to buy it back before Yovel, and it will stay permanently by him, as opposed to if he doesn't buy it back, then it's going to go to the Kohanim, it's going to be given to the Kohanim on Yom Kippur of the next Yovel. And the son has the same din as his father as far as that if the son bought the field back from Hekdesh, the same din will apply that it stays in the family. As opposed to there's no other relative where that's true of.
So uncles would buy it.
If an uncle would buy it, we would still say that no, it's not in the possession of the original Makdish anymore, and therefore it goes to the Kohanim, yeah. And Tosfos points out another example where we have a son stands in place of a father is as far as an Eved Ivri. A person buys an Eved Ivri, and in the middle of 6 years he passes away, then his son takes over and continues being able to use the Eved Ivri till the end of the 6 years.
Doesn't go free.
When it comes to an Eved Nirtza is different. The Gemara works out in Kiddushin that if his ear was pierced and he stays on to Yovel, then he goes free when the Odin passes away, but a regular Eved Ivri now. Anyway, so you have several examples where we see that a son stands in place of his father. Well, the Gemara asks, Adrabba Marbani, or the Braisa continues, Adrabba Marbani as Ach, Shekin Kom Tachas Ovel Yibum. Yeah, but you could argue, on the other hand, maybe the brother should be considered a closer relative because he stands in place of his brother as far as Yibum.
That's only when there's no
choice. That's the answer. The whole point is there's no yibum unless there's no children. When there's children, then there's no yibum. So yes, the son outranks the brother because the whole point is only when there's no sons, only then is there even a concept of yibum. Okay, so thus far the braisa. So now the Gemara points out, let's start analyzing this. Taima de ikka hai pircha. So what are you telling me? Because you have that pircha, because you're pointing out that yibum only comes into play only if there's no children, only because of that are we saying that a son is stronger than a brother? Paul lav hochi, and if it weren't for that, have amina och adif, you would tell me that a brother is stronger? You have a better reason to say that a son is considered a closer relative anyway. Typically, don't you have a better reason? Dehocha tarti v'hocha chada. After all, by a son, you have two things that the Gemara had mentioned, yield and Sedei Achuzah, and then by a brother, you only have one yibum. And anyway, two is more than one, so that should be alone reason enough to say that the brother is, that the son is considered a closer relative than the brother. And the answer is Sedei Achuzah Gufa, my high timer who, because the very fact that this din by Sedei Achuzah applies only to the son and not to anybody else is based on the same svara, to Kakaimale Latana. The Tana, in Erchin, where these dinim are discussed, gets it in the same way. Because you have the same argument that's made over there. On the one hand, why should we say that din of buying back the Sedei Achuzah and it staying in the family applies only to a son? Maybe instead it should apply to a brother because the brother is considered his brother's replacement as far as Yibum. And again, the answer is over there, and if there's a son, then there's no Yibum. So in other words, You really only have, it's one against one. And then once you have the din, once you have the point that, so all you have really is the din of, so you have, in other words, to begin with, you know, there's the din of yiyud, which says clearly in the pasuk. And on the other hand, you have the din of yibum with a brother that says clearly in the pasuk. Now, when we want to figure out, should it be more similar to yiyud or should it be more similar to yibum? Then the logic comes in that there's no yibum when there's a son in the first place and therefore the brother isn't considered to have. So all you're left with is the one thing that the pasuk gives him, which is yibum, and only when there's no son. But in other words, you can't say you have two independent things, yud and sde achoza, where a son is stronger, because the very fact that din applies to sde achoza itself is learned by comparing and contrasting yibum versus
neutral.
So one is kind of like neutral. So you only have one against one, which is why we really needed the argument klum yesh ben, which tells us, in other words, inherently the advantage of the brother as far as yibum is a very weak one compared to the stronger one that the son has as far as yield. And therefore, that's reason to say that the son is considered a closer relative, and therefore that's the result, so that the son is the first one to inherit from his father, and only if there's no children, then it goes to the father, and only if there's no father, then it goes to the brothers.
So there's no other sources besides these two.
So that's it as far as the comparison and contrast between brother and father. But now, between brother and son. But now, the Gemara is going to continue on analyzing. We said in the Braisa that She'era means the father. And we said that means the father goes ahead of, that means the father goes ahead of the brothers. So the Gemara is going to continue with the discussion. Well, maybe it means then that I guess we could learn a little further since we're not going to be able to learn tomorrow to learn anyhow. So the Gemara continues. Fine, you're telling me that she'era, we learn from that that the father goes ahead, but maybe that means malamet sha'av kodem l'bas. Maybe that means that the father goes ahead only of a daughter. Yocho yakdem l'ben. And you would think that he goes ahead of a son. Kodem. In other words, maybe the argument should be, so you're telling me that what? The father goes ahead of the brothers, but he doesn't go ahead of a son because he said Kodem. And we explain why a son is considered a closer relative than a brother. Well, maybe, though, we should say that a brother is considered a closer relative than a daughter, because after all, yud that we just discussed doesn't apply to a daughter. Sde achoza doesn't apply to a daughter either. So you really have nothing in which a daughter is stronger than a brother. So why don't we say then that the order should be, if the guy has sons, the one who passed away has sons, then his sons yashin him, they go first. But if he doesn't have any sons, then it doesn't go to his daughter, then it goes to his father. And only if his father is no longer living, then it goes to his daughters. So to take the example of Tzlofa, let's say hypothetically, let's understand the Braisa to mean, let the Braisa understand the Psukim to mean that Tzlofa has daughters. But they don't yarshin unless Tzlofchad's father, Chefer, has already passed away. And if Chefer was still alive, then maybe Chefer would go first.
So if they had sons, son goes.
So the order would be sons, father, daughters. Why don't we say that? Why do the daughters also get to go ahead of the father? And the answer is, because when it comes to yibum, a son and a daughter are on an equal level. If a person left behind a son or a daughter, either way, there's no yibum. So therefore, when it comes to nachla also, a son and daughter are on an equal level, not in that the daughter herself is not going to yarshin if she has brothers, but in the sense that they're both on the same level in the tree of Yerusha, in the sense that both of them go ahead of the father. So the Gemara continues. How about we could learn possibly another way? She'era means the father, and that would mean the father comes ahead of the father's brothers. Yocho yakdem la'achim, and maybe we would think that he goes ahead of the brothers. In other words, maybe we would say that maybe the father go like this. Where are we slotting in the father? Remember, the father it doesn't say in the pasuk. We have to figure out where we're slotting him in. So far, we established that we can't slot him in ahead of the son or ahead of the daughter. But we're saying we do put him in ahead of the Nifter's brothers. So in our example that we said before, when Reuven passes away, again, if Yaakov is still alive and Reuven didn't leave any children, then Yaakov will inherit, and only if Yaakov himself already has passed away, then Shimon and Levi are going to inherit. Now, how do we know? Maybe the other way around. Maybe we would say that the father goes behind them. Maybe the order is, if Reuven has passed away childless, Shimon and Levi get, and only if there's no other brothers, then the father gets.
Why would you think that? Where would that be able to
work? Well, why not? I mean, we have to figure out where the father is going in. He doesn't say in the pasuk. So how do we know that we how do we know that he's going to
support him all the time?
That doesn't matter. But first of all, maybe not. But that's not the point. The point is that how do we know based on the pasuk? If we're learning from the word she'eray, and the word she'eray is at the end of the whole listing, and we're having to put him someplace earlier in the listing, what makes us say that he goes ahead of Reuven's brothers? Maybe he goes behind them. Only if Reuven has no brothers, only then Yaakov inherits.
Besides using the word uncle, the father brothers have really nothing to do with it.
Right, so that's basically the answer. That's basically the answer. Achei ha'av, like Sushi Krah, you don't really need to mention the father's brothers, because in other words, we're saying you would say hypothetically, you know who the father goes ahead of his own brothers. Meaning, in other words, in our scenario, if Yaakov and if Reuven passed away childless, and Shimon and Levi had also passed away, and Yaakov had also passed away, then it would go to Yaakov, and if Yaakov is no longer there, then the pasuk says it would go to Esav, because it would go La'cheav. So maybe you'd say, fine, Yaakov goes ahead of Esav, but not necessarily ahead of anybody else. But the answer is Acheav, like Tzrichi Krah. You really don't need a pasuk to tell us that Yaakov would go ahead of his brothers. Acheav, Mikoyach Manka also, Mikoyachav. Because they only come through the power of the father. He's only Reuven's uncle. He's only Reuven's relative by virtue of Yaakov. So they're coming. Would you think that if the father was alive, that if Yaakov was alive, then instead Esav would inherit? Obviously not. So it's very clear that it's logical, yeah, that it has to be that the maximum we can say is that Yaakov is going to go ahead of Reuven's brothers of Shimon and Levi, but not of Yaakov's own brother. We don't need a pasuk to tell us that. So the Gemara finishes off then. The problem is, the fact is, the psukim are written out of order. She'era is at the end of the whole list. Because the pasuk says, if the father has no brothers, then it says you give up the she'era akore deilam. So that implies, in other words, that the father goes last in the list. And the answer is, okay, Kroshaloi Kasidra and Ksivi, fine, the psukim are written out of order. It has to be by logic that we said the father comes first. The pasuk is the Rashbam explains, and the pasuk is just where the pasuk is relying on the point that we already established that karev koredem, and therefore at that point you can use your own logic to figure out what the order should be. Now the Rashbam also points out that you could say in that case, then why does the Torah even have to give the whole list at all? Let the pasuk just say when a person passed away, you give it to his closest relative, and we'd work out for ourselves what the closest relative is. The answer is that Rashbam says the Gemara is going to point out later on in the parak. We're going to learn many different things that we learn from the psukim individually, where it says uvein ein loy means ayin olav, means we have to investigate, did the son leave behind any descendants. If there's no daughters, if in ein loy bas, also means ayin aleha, means you have to investigate and see if she's no longer living, but did she leave any descendants, etc. So it needs to mention ein loy by each one of them, because we have to go down that path of the tree and see if there are any, and then work our way up recursively, and then therefore it couldn't have just said you give lakarev, because then we wouldn't know that whole concept. But nevertheless, we can put the she'eray at the end, and we can logically understand that she'eray, once we understand that she'eray means his father, then we ourselves can logically figure out where he belongs in the list based on the whole svara that we worked out all this time. So now the next piece of the Gemara is going to point out there's a different way of learning that the father Yarshins, which again we said is a drosha, that we know the father Yarshins. It doesn't say clearly in the pasuk. So far we went through one drosha from a braisa. So the Gemara is going to go on to bring a different drosha from which we can learn. Not arguing on the din, but arguing on where we learn it from.